All right. Well, she was upstairs. My daughter was upstairs watching some kind of video on her computer, and also was doing stuff on her phone. And you know how the kids are nowadays. They have two things going at once. So that may have been the cause of the going in and out. So we'll see if the sound is more consistent now. but again, hello, everyone. And we are here now for the spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi. And I have been going through this book very, 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 very slowly. In fact, I don't know, I think I've done this 7 weeks in a row. And we have done one, two, three pages. So at this rate, I will be reading this book for the rest of my life. But that's okay with me. I want to start by talking a little bit about meditation, because I had a conversation recently with a couple of people, and I felt, based on the feedback that I was getting in the conversation, that some of what I was saying about meditation was being misunderstood. And, you know, I don't know that I can make myself clear. but I would like to just try again. I'd like to try again. And primarily, the conversation was about last week's practice. Last week, we were looking at question 11. And you may remember we took two 10-minute meditation breaks. And during that 10-minute meditation break, if a thought came into the mind, you know, we were practicing asking, to whom does this thought arise, right? And then asking, who am I? And one person that I was talking to seemed to misunderstand that as meaning we were watching for thoughts. So kind of like I noticed the name Hunting for Truth in the room. I'm going to kind of make a play off that name, like we were hunting for thoughts. We should be hunting for truth. The name is correct. But the misunderstanding was like we were hunting for thoughts. So what the person thought was that we were closing the eyes and eagerly almost awaiting the next thought so that we could shoot at it, you know, shoot at it with our little to whom does this appear thing, like we were trying to, blow the thoughts away. I mean, if you imagine, just imagine that little image that, you know, you're in there with a little gun in your brain and you're waiting for a thought to show up so you can shoot at it and blow it away. And then here comes another one, shoot at it and blow away, kind of like the little yellow ducks at the carnival, right? And that's not what we're doing. So I thought that I would try again to share at least my experience. Now this week, I think I mentioned to you all that I was going to use this better during my meditation in the next week, which now would have been last week. And the reason I say use this better is because this has been my form of transitioning from outward focus attention to inward focused attention for quite some time. So basically for quite some time, for, you know, maybe since I began meditation, right? So for quite some time, when I close my eyes, I move into the Ramana Maharshi type of self-inquiry. But what I noticed last week when we were doing this together is that there had been a bit of a laziness in my self-inquiry, in that I would sometimes sit there and let, you know, several sentences pass by, and I would have interest. In other words, I would still have outward going attention in those sentences, in that little inward conversation for some time, you know, again, maybe 10 sentences, maybe 15 sentences, never for an extreme amount of time, but I was letting several sentences pass before I was practicing self-inquiry and turning the attention back inward. And what I vowed to do last week, which may have been what gave the impression that I was thought hunting, what I vowed to do last week was practice inquiry on the very first sentence, on every single thought, so that there was no outward going attention. And I can totally see, as I'm listening to myself now, I can totally see how that gave the impression that I was hunting for thoughts. But that's not what it's like for me. That's not my experience in spite of the words and what they sound like. So what I want to do, as I mentioned, is I want to try again to describe what this experience is like. Now, first of all, I remember I once heard Pema Chodron say that she has a very active mind. And I giggled because I also have a very active mind. However, that mind can be brought to a quieter position pretty quickly, you know, with a little bit of attention to doing that. When I close my eyes, let me just try and describe what happens. When I close my eyes to go into awareness, watching awareness meditation, the first thing that happens is that my attention goes to some thought. It's just as soon as I close my eyes, it's like the ego's response to me closing the eyes is, okay, let's sit here and think. And if I did nothing, right, if I did nothing, what would happen if I sat there for half an hour and a half? What would happen is I would sit there with my eyes closed, but still with an outward going attention, just listening to my thoughts. I would literally just sit there and think if I did nothing but close my eyes. So what I use is a tool. And the purpose of the tool is to shift that attention. The attention is going out to thought. What I want to do is I want to take that attention and I want to turn it around. And I want to point it at the true self, point it at awareness. We can also say point it away from thought. And this is why I say it's not hunting for thoughts, because the real goal is not to find the next thought and shoot it too. The real goal is to turn the attention around, to face away from thought into awareness. So hunting for truth is very appropriate. But because my mind just wants to sit there and think for an hour and a half, again, I need a tool to accomplish that turnaround. And the tool that I have used for quite some time is the Ramana Maharshi method of self-inquiry. So the way that works is I close my eyes, and just before I came in here today, into Pal Talk today, I was working with Ken on the new radio station. So if I close my eyes, it's likely my attention might go straight to the radio, right? Because that's where I have been working. So I close my eyes and, you know, maybe the mind starts to say, oh yeah, when Ken gets that test station up, then you'll have to look at it, figure out what artwork you want on the radio player. And I wonder how hard it is to insert the artwork. I wonder if we don't have the right dimension of picture. I wonder, am I going to have to go get Paint Shop Pro, you know, so I can get the right dimension of picture. And, you know, that's what my mind does as soon as I close my eyes, right? It goes to work. So what I do is I close my eyes. And what I'm committed to now is on that first sentence, right? Instead of letting that much fly by, which was, what, 5 or 6 sentences, I didn't count them. Instead of letting that much fly by, I close my eyes, and that first sentence shows up something about, I got to go pick out artwork for the radio, right there. I say, to whom does this thought appear? And when I say, to whom does this thought appear, I am not shooting at the thought. I am immediately turning my attention to see, to whom does this thought appear. I'm turning my attention away from the thought to awareness. And then if I feel I need a deepening of that, kind of a going deeper into awareness, I can follow it up with the question, who am I? By the way, that was something else that was misunderstood, so hopefully I'll remember to come back to that. In fact, I'm going to type myself a note. Now, because my mind is the way it is, this total turnaround and this staying in awareness for me, at least so far, doesn't happen with just one try. It'd be great if it did. If it happened with just one try, I would ask the question once and be done, and I would just set in awareness, and I would never ask the question again. But it doesn't. That the attention will turn around for a moment, and then, you know, kind of like a little kid who thinks mom's not looking, so I can go back to what I was doing, it turns right back around, and it starts to get engrossed in another thought. So The problem is not that another thought came. The problem, as I experience it, is that attention turned back around to thought. You see? I'm watching where is attention. And attention turned back around to thought again and wanted to get back engrossed. And if I didn't fall for the radio story, well, there's some website stuff I can think about, right? So as soon as I see that attention turn back around and get engrossed in thought again, I ask the question right then. And actually, I have noticed I kind of shorten the questions myself in my daily practice. I just say, to whom? And to whom, again, the attention turns back around to look to see to whom. To whom does this thought appear? Who is witnessing this? And again, if I feel I need to ask another question to get more solid in that looking back at awareness, I follow it up with, who am I? Right? Now, while I am in awareness, while my attention is solidly looking at awareness, thoughts do continue to come. And I do not ask the question if the attention is still focused on awareness. If the thoughts are kind of in the background, if attention is focused on awareness, awareness is the foreground, and the thoughts are just in the background going by, I pay no attention to them. I do not inquire into them. It's unnecessary. It's not my concern about whether thoughts are coming and going. My only concern is, what is attention attending to? But if attention turns around and starts paying attention to those thoughts again, right, I ask the question again. To whom does this appear? Or to whom? Right? So that's the way I use it. So again, we're not here to look at every thought and shoot it. Once I'm solidly in awareness, awareness is in the foreground of my attention, that's what I'm paying attention to, I just ignore the thoughts in the background. I'm not trying to grab each of them. But when attention gets interested, that's when I ask the self-inquiry question again. So hopefully that's a little more clear. The second thing that was misunderstood by another person, I think, had to do with the who am I. And I don't think, you know, I could be wrong. I don't think this misunderstanding came from me. I think this misunderstanding probably just came from the person themselves. but let me go ahead and address it. The person thought that when I asked the question, who am I, that I was trying to figure out who I, the ego, is. I, the person, is. That I was trying to figure out who I am. And what the person said is, trying to correct me out of that misunderstanding, what the person said is, you aren't supposed to pay attention to the I in meditation. You're supposed to pay attention to what's aware of the I. And I agree with that completely. When I ask the question, who am I, that is going back to awareness, to that which is aware of the person, aware of the body, aware of the thoughts, aware of the sounds, aware of the sensations. And in fact, a couple of weeks ago, we looked at the fact that Ramana Maharshi calls this I, right? It's like, it's not the first I, which is the false self. It's the second I, which is the awareness that's aware of the false self. So he calls it I. And in fact, he said, even if one thinks constantly, I, one will be led to that place. And that place that he's talking about is that which is before the ego thought I, the awareness from which the ego thought I arises out of, the spaciousness or the emptiness or the awareness that the ego thought I arises out of. So, of course, one challenge always whenever speaking about spirituality, and I know you guys know this, is words. You know, words are a problem. But if we understand the heart of the practice, then the words are not a problem. So this week, when practicing awareness, watching awareness, I did continue to use the tool that I've always used, which was the self-inquiry. To whom does this appear, or to whom? Or frequently before, I used to always say, who or what sees this? That's another form of the same question. Who or what sees this? And then who am I? Hunting for truth, right? Turning that attention around and seeking to abide there. Awareness, watching awareness. And I feel that is probably the heart of Ramana Maharshi's teaching, as well as the heart of Nisargadatta Maharaja's teaching, as well as the heart of Michael Langford's teaching and the heart of Rupert Spira's teaching and the heart of Adyashanti's teaching and the heart of Eckhart Tolle's teaching. Right? When I hear them, they express this in with different words, but I keep hearing the same thing over and over. So I think this, let me just pause. Does anybody have any questions? All right, then. Can I please, I can pronounce that word for you, but I cannot guarantee that I'm pronouncing it correctly. Now, first of all, do you mean because you have it ending with a D. There's the Bhagavad Gita, and then the Bhagavad Gita, and then there's also Bhagavan Ramana Maharshi. So they're two slightly different words. And actually I say the V because I'm an American. Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavan Ramana Maharshi. But actually I think Indians do not say the V. I think it's more like a Bhagawan or Bhagawad. But the best person to ask would be an Indian. But most Americans will say Bhagavan and Bhagavad. Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavan Ramana Maharshi. Yeah. And it means God. Yeah. All right. Bhagavad. You probably want Bhagavad Gita because you're having to announce that. Yeah. Today the registration for that class closes, so you won't have to announce it after today. All right. So why don't we go to the next thing that we have. And actually, if I read all of question 12, we're going to cover a whole page and a half today because the answer is that long. So let's see what happens. So question number 12, which is on page 6. Now Ramana had just taught, the previous question had been, what is the best means for making the mind quiet? That was question 10. And the answer had been by the inquiry, who am I? And in fact, In fact, let me bring this point up too. Remember Ramana Maharshi said that the thought, who am I, will destroy all other thoughts. And again, he uses that. It makes it sound like you're hunting for thoughts and you're shooting it. But I really feel he means what I'm experiencing, that it turns your attention around so you're not paying attention to thought. Right? He says, the thought, who am I, will destroy all other thoughts, and like the stick used for stirring the burning pyre, it will itself in the end get destroyed. And that is also my experience, because since I am using to whom does this appear, right, to whom and who am I, to turn my attention around, when my attention is turned around, as I mentioned, I no longer ask the question. So the question is used to remove my attention from being interested in thought and place my attention so that it's literally interested in awareness. But once the attention is genuinely interested in awareness and very happy to be placed there, the question that I used, the tool that I used, also gets thrown away. Then it's resting without a thought. Again, there may be thoughts running in the background, but there's no active use of thought occurring, right? So the question was, how will the mind become quiet? And Ramana Maharshi's answer was, who am I? You use that for as long as you need to, and then you throw it away as well, right? And so then the next question was, well, how can I hold on to the thought, who am I? How do I do that, right? And that's whenever a thought arises, say, to whom does this thought arise, right? And then ask, who am I? And again, he's teaching how to turn the attention around and keep the attention on awareness. So after he gave that answer, the questioner says, are there no other means for making the mind quiet? All right, so this is the answer. Other than inquiry, there are no adequate means. If through other means it is sought to control the mind will appear to be controlled, but will again go forth. Through the control of breath, also the mind will become quiet, but it will be quiet only so long as the breath remains controlled. And when the breath resumes, the mind also will again start moving, and will wander as impelled by residual impressions. The source is the same for both mind and breath. Thought, indeed, is the nature of the mind. The thought I is the first thought of the mind, and that is egoity. It is from that whence egoity originates that breath also originates. Therefore, when the mind becomes quiet, the breath is controlled. And when the breath is controlled, the mind becomes quiet. But in deep sleep, although the mind becomes quiet, the breath does not stop. This is because of the will of God, so that the body may be preserved, and other people may not be under the impression that it is dead. In the state of waking and in samadhi, when the mind becomes quiet, the breath is controlled. Breath is the gross form of mind. Till the time of death, the mind keeps breath in the body. And when the body dies, the mind takes the breath along with it. Therefore, the exercise of breath control is only an aid for rendering the mind quiet. It will not destroy the mind. Like the practice of breath control, meditation on the forms of God, repetition of mantras, restriction on food, are but aids for rendering the mind quiet. Through meditation on the forms of God, and through repetition of mantras, the mind becomes one-pointed. The mind will always be wandering, just as when the chain is given to an elephant to hold in its trunk, it will go along grasping the chain and nothing else. So also when the mind is occupied with a name or form, it will grasp that alone. When the mind expands in the form of countless thoughts, each thought becomes weak. But as thoughts get resolved, the mind becomes one-pointed and strong. For such a mind, self-inquiry will become easy. Of all the restrictive rules that relating to the taking of sattvic food in moderate quantities is best, by observing this rule, the sattvic quality of mind will increase, and that will be helpful to self-inquiry. So it's a pretty long answer, and my impression, and if you will take this as that, as an impression, my impression is that his answer is cultural-based. He is probably talking to an Indian, and he knows the general ideas Indians have about meditation and enlightenment. And so when the man asks, are there no other means for making the mind quiet, he is responding to all of the other means that Indians might rattle off as, well, you know, we can do this and this and this and this. And he's responding to what is helpful and what is not helpful. First of all, he says none of them are the means that will take you all the way to menonasa, or mind death, or ego death. He's saying the only thing that will take you all the way is self-inquiry. And again, my feeling is it's not because of the questions themselves. It's that desire to look at the true self and to abide in the true self instead of looking at the mind and abiding in the mind, right? That's what ends mind. Because mind does not have its own life. Mind's appearance to have life comes from our attention, which is life. Our awareness and life are one. You know, you can call life God or the Father or the Absolute, and you can call awareness the Son of God, if you want to use the Christian terms. Indians sometimes would call life the unmanifest, and they might call awareness the first level of manifestation, right? But you have the Father and the Son using Christian terms. But what's really important about all non-dual spiritual teaching is there isn't two. There's not the manifest and the unmanifest. There's not the Father and the Son. That would be two. Those two are one. Life and awareness are one. You cannot separate life from awareness. It's impossible. So your attention, which is an aspect of awareness, is infused with life. And so when you give your attention to thoughts, they appear, you know, the ego appears to live, right? But if you take your attention away from thoughts and you just leave the attention with the true self, with the awareness, in that way, you could say the ego will starve because it has no life of its own, and it will end. Now, Cheryl is asking, Regina, it's the attention you give to thoughts, giving it meaning, so to speak, yes? Yeah, maybe, and another word might be value. You're giving your attention to thoughts because they have meaning to you or value to you or importance to you, right? And that's why you're giving your attention. That's why you're paying attention to them. If the thoughts were chattering about something that you had no interest in, you would naturally ignore them. But the thoughts are chattering about things you do have interest in. That's the challenge. So again, Ramana Maharshi begins by saying self-inquiry is the only adequate means, right? And again, by self-inquiry, he really means turning your attention to awareness and paying attention to awareness instead of paying attention to thought. Thought will die, right? The mind will die. the ego attachment to thought as me will die. All right? But then he goes on to talk about some other common beliefs. And the first one he really talks about for quite a bit is breath control. And, you know, I haven't done a lot of reading. I mean, I've read the Bhagavad Gita, but I haven't done a lot of reading of the Upanishads or other Indian Hindu texts. But I do think that breath control is a very common teaching from the little bit that I know. And he seems to be saying that that method of meditation is completely inadequate. And what's interesting is if you read Adya Shanti's True Meditation, Adya seems to have the same general impression. Like, you know, that he probably started with breath control as a means of meditation, and that he discovered, right, he discovered abiding in awareness as true meditation, right? That this meditation he had been taught was not it. And he discovered true meditation. For me, I have never even taken to breath control. You know, early on, I took a meditation class, and breath control is one of the things that they attempted to teach, and I just didn't like it. I mean, I just didn't like it and never even tried it. But if I imagine myself now practicing breath control, really practicing breath control, my attention is on the breath, which means my attention is still outgoing. I could practice breath control for 12 hours a day and still not spend a single moment paying attention to awareness. And you know, Ramana Maharshi says that when the body dies, it takes the breath along with it, right? Which means if you've been focused outward on the breath, that's like being focused outward on the body. And, you know, you didn't really achieve anything. The body dies, the breath ends, and you've achieved nothing. And again, that's not overly important to me because I never really liked breath control anyway. So I was like, okay, I won't do it. You know, I didn't like it. Now I don't have to do it. But then the next thing he says, he talks about meditating on the forms of God. And of course, that would be meditating on the image of a God in your mind. And the Hindus would imagine, you know, like Shiva in the mind, or they would imagine like Ganeshan in the mind, or Pavarotti in the mind. He says meditation on the forms of God. And then he also talks about repetition of mantras. He says through these, the mind becomes one-pointed. And he doesn't go on to say that these two types of meditation are useless. In fact, he seems to imply that these two types of meditations can be preparation for self-inquiry. So he doesn't seem to see them as outward focused, for some reason, as watching the breath. And in fact, in the teachings of Inner Ramana, which you all know is my inner receiving of the teachings of Ramana Maharshi, I was actually given a mantra. Remember, I was given the mantra, I am that I am. And at that point, when I was given that mantra, I had no inkling, zero inkling about awareness. My attention had always been outward focused. My spiritual practice up until that time had been still outward focused, but it was outward focused on, is this the right mind or is this the wrong mind? And if it was a wrong-minded thought, an ego thought, learning to let it go. And if it was a right-minded thought, learning to embrace it, trust it, and follow it, you know, following guidance, we call it. But if you get really, really subtle in your spiritual maturity, although that is a helpful stage, you will notice that's a purely outward focused at thought practice. And up until the point when I was given the mantra, that's all I knew. I didn't have any inkling of anything prior to thought. The only ideas I had is some thoughts are, ego, and some thoughts are from spirit. And so without any training at all about awareness, I was given this mantra. And I was told to repeat it as often as it came into the mind to repeat it. I was told to repeat it with devotion, right, lovingly, with gratitude. And I think this I think might have been the most important part. I was told to linger in the quiet that followed the mantra, for as long as I lingered, right? And at some point, and it seems to me in my memory that I was literally walking across the backyard from my house to my neighbor's house, walking across the grass. I think I may have even been looking down at the grass when I had my first glimpse of awareness, my first realization of myself as awareness. And I remember the thought that followed that thought was, now I know what the something real is. Because A Course in Miracles begins with, nothing real can be threatened. Nothing unreal exists, right? And I was familiar with that, but I had no idea what the something real was. The something real was still a mystery to me. I was really ignorant spiritually. But in that moment, I knew I'm the something real, not Regina, not that I, right? But what I really am. And so it was the practice of the mantra for me was some kind of a bridge. And what I loved about it is, I was never told, in my experience, I was never told to expect this from the mantra. In fact, I wasn't told to expect anything from the mantra. I was just told to do it. So why a mantra might have that kind of effect, I don't know. But Ramana Maharshi, if you look at him in his lifetime, he did from time to time give mantras to certain students. But not just me. So apparently he was able to see when someone wasn't ready for, self-inquiry or awareness, watching awareness, like they just wouldn't have got it. If you had told me at that point to practice awareness, watching awareness, I wouldn't have had a clue what you were talking about. I mean, I just would not have understood. I might have tried watching the breath. I don't know what I would have done. And so, Ramana Maharshi as a teacher, as a truly enlightened teacher, would have that feel of, this person is not going to understand that instruction. It's not going to mean anything. So I will give them this. And this will, if they practice this, this will be like a bridge that will prepare them for the real practice of self-inquiry or awareness, watching awareness. And again, if you pay attention to bigger books about Ramana Maharshi's life, you will see that there were many times that he gave what we might call these lesser practices to people. Meditating on the form of God, just holding the image of, Shiva or Ganeshan. My guess is the reason he approves of that is because it's devotional. It opens the heart. And Ramana Maharshi is very clear that surrender is actually, really surrendering into devotion is another way to realize truth. In this paragraph, he's not clear. He says, here, self-inquiry, there's no other adequate means. But in other places, he's clear that is another path for some people. And so if you are Hindu and you're raised to love Shiva or raised to love Ganeshan or somebody else, right? It might be like, some Americans raised to love Jesus. And to just hold that image, in our case, maybe it would be Jesus, just to hold that image in the mind and not chatter, but just to be with Jesus. That could be a very important transitional practice, right? So, meditating on the forms of God or repeating mantras, he recommends as a strengthening practice. He calls it strengthens the mind. Kind of reminds me of A Course in Miracles says that an untrained mind can do nothing. Isn't that what it says? Something like that? An untrained mind can accomplish nothing. Maybe that's what it says. And in fact, that's the purpose of the Course in Miracles workbook. It's really the same purpose as the mantra and meditating on the forms of God, right? It's to take you from a completely undisciplined mind. Oh, maybe that's what the Course says. An undisciplined mind can accomplish nothing. I think those are the words. It's to take you from an undisciplined mind to a strong mind. But it's still just the bridge. It's not the final practice. It's not the practice that takes you to Mananasa or ego death. Right? They're preparation practices. So the Course in Miracles workbook is a preparation to discipline the mind, to prepare it for the final practice. Okay, Dove says, I'm using all the wrong words, and Dove, who I trust completely, says an untrained mind can't accomplish nothing. Yeah. And meditating on the forms of God, or repeating a mantra such as I am that I am. And in fact, in A Course in Miracles, there are 2 days we've seen so far where the Course had us repeating the name of God, thinking the name of God throughout the day. And in fact, it never tells you what the name of God is. So for some people, that may have even been holding an image of Jesus in the mind. Right? So in a way, we've seen these same two practices show up in the Course as a form of strengthening the mind or training the mind. Right? So he does have some approval of those types of practices if that is where you're at. And I would say that's for each of us to know. Each of us really knows how disciplined or undisciplined, how trained or untrained our mind is. And if we feel that it's helpful to do some mind training first to strengthen the mind, well, again, you've got the Course. You know, the Course with its hourly remembrance, right? Today, I trust my brothers who are one with me, right? Hourly remembrance, that's a mind training thing, a strengthening of the mind. Or you practice the mantra, you know, like in Inner Ramana, I am that I am. Or maybe you meditate on a form of God, you're just constantly recalling Jesus or some other meaningful God into your mind. Training the mind, preparing the mind for awareness, watching awareness. And then he also talks about, he says, of all the restrictive rules, and I think that Hindus do have a lot of restrictive rules, you know, because they have, you know, one of the things that's in their belief system is that idea of, well, remember when Prince Siddhartha first went out to become enlightened, remember the first thing he did was deprive himself of everything, right? Complete deprivation. And that thought process is in the Hindu culture. That you take away all of the creature comforts. You take away the food. You take away the clothing. You take away the shelter. And that somehow, you know, through this very, very strict living, you will achieve enlightenment. And so he just says of all the restrictive rules, just kind of, you know, throwing a shout out to all of those rules. He says of all the restrictive rules, only one is really helpful, but there is one that's helpful. Diet. And by diet, he's referring to the sattvic food, which, you know, you can look up a list of sattvic food, but I personally don't think that's overly important. If you prefer to trust Ramana Maharshi than me, and you might, and I get that, and I'm okay with it if you do. If you choose to trust Ramana Maharshi over me, you can go look up sattvic foods, a list of sattvic foods, and eat only that. And I think Michael Langford did and still does, right? So I think he went with this recommendation all the way. So maybe that's what you want to do. Maybe you shouldn't even listen to me. Right now, at this point, can I spell that word? Sure, it's S-A-T-T-V-I-C. Right now, where I sit today... I don't feel that I need to eat from the list of sattvic foods completely. But I would say that my diet really leans generally in that way. I have given up meat, except for fish. And I eat beef maybe 2 to 3 times a year. I have fish and turkey. I have just lost all, I don't know what it is about them, but you know, I used to love them, but now they don't even seem like food to me. You know, I mean, I just lost all interest. But my primary diet is fruits, vegetables, a little bit of bread, and nuts. Occasionally milk, cheese, and eggs, but they're not even on a daily basis. They're also very, you know, occasional. You know, like, I don't know, maybe I have dairy once a week. Chocolate is still there, but I'll tell you my primary form of chocolate. If you go to the supermarket in the frozen section now, they have these things, they're called dippers. I like the bananas. It's like 4 banana slices dipped in dark chocolate, and I do eat those. Yeah, so it's a little bit of chocolate around a banana slice. I love them. I have one almost every day. But once or twice a week, instead of my dippers, I will have popcorn. So those are my primary snacks. But as you can see, it's a pretty clean diet. And I think that's the point. I'm about out of time, but I think that's the point, is that it is helpful to have a clean diet. And I think even though it's not here, Ramana Maharshi would also say it's also helpful to get exercise and the right amount of sleep. If you have a clean diet, a reasonable amount of exercise, and the right amount of sleep, your body is going to be stronger, your mind is going to be stronger, and that is going to assist in awareness, watching, awareness, meditation. So, I need to go. We're out of time. It's been great talking to you. Bye.